From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Selma.
Rockridge.
Tracy, California.
Noe Valley.
Everywhere, I'm homeless.
Coming up, we'll see what goes on behind prison walls at Pelican Bay.
These prison gangs control multi-million dollar organizations.
And get firsthand insight into how they're being controlled.
You have, 23 hours in your cell a day for self-reflection.
Also, we'll continue our series on indeterminate prison sentencing. We'll hear about the bathroom stall busts at UC Berkeley. And we'll go behind the scenes of a play about coming to grips with the murder of Mayor George Moscone.
Every night I watch the show, I'm always sitting next to someone who recognizes, figures out who I am. And then they kind of hold my hand because they know I'm scared. And they're like, are you okay? I'm like, who are you?
Stay tuned for a special one-hour edition of Cross Currents. If you're convicted of a felony in California, you can end up in many kinds of prisons. Steal a lot of money in a Ponzi scheme, you might end up in minimum security. Locked up but with little supervision. Commit a violent crime, and you could be sent to a medium security prison, like Folsom. Kill someone, and you could be headed for maximum security incarceration. Pelican State Bay Prison in Crescent City is one of California's two maximum security prisons. About 3,230 of California's most violent criminals live there. And those who cause problems within prison walls end up in the Security Housing Unit, or SHU. It's highly restricted living conditions that some consider solitary confinement. And those stuck in the SHU for years say it can be literally maddening. Last year, some of those inmates took part in a hunger strike, and they were quickly joined by more than 1,000 prisoners around the state. KLW's criminal justice reporter Rena Palta took a tour of Pelican Bay to see what spurred the protests behind prison walls.
Crescent City is a small coastal town 13 miles south of the Oregon border. It's primarily known for two things: a tsunami that wiped the town clean in 1964, and Pelican Bay State Prison, widely thought of as California's toughest. Pelican Bay houses some of California's most violent criminals, designated as Level 4 or high security. On a summer afternoon, about 100 are out in the yard.
In about 15 minutes, you're going to probably see about 130, 40 men out here exercising, running, doing workouts.
Lieutenant Chris Acosta is Pelican Bay's public information officer. He says here, just like in most of the state's men's prisons, the dynamics of the yard are governed by race.
Over here, you have the Southern Hispanics at this area. Then you got over there the area where all the Bloods hang out. You got another area with the Hispanics is the Mexican Nationals. You got the non-affiliated Blacks. You got the Crips. You can't go solo here and make it on your own, especially on a level 4 high security prison yard. There's no way. So guess what? They have to go with everybody else.
Acosta says some inmates manage to lay low, stay out of trouble, and do their time. Others get recruited by prison gangs that offer protection and the possibility of money and power. Lieutenant Dave Barnaberg is a gang investigator at Pelican Bay.
These prison gangs control multi-million dollar organizations. They're responsible for a majority of violence in our general populations and a majority of criminal activity associated with criminal street gangs in our communities.
California prison officials have been grappling with how to deal with these gangs for decades, and the SHU at Pelican Bay is one solution. There are two ways to end up in the SHU. First, inmates who commit crimes while in prison can be sentenced to a period here. Second, an inmate can be sent to the SHU indefinitely if he's validated as a prison gang member or affiliate. About 1,000 of the 1,100 prisoners housed at Pelican Bay's SHU don't know when they'll get out.
This is the main entrance to our security housing unit. I want everybody to take 5 seconds and be quiet. What do you hear? There's 600 guys housed over here. It's pretty quiet over here in SHU.
SHU units are designed to minimize prisoner communication. The idea is that if you take away a gang leader's ability to communicate with his followers, you take away the gang's organization and power. Inmates are kept, usually by themselves, in 6-by-10-foot cells for between 22 and 23 hours a day. The cells have no windows, only a red steel mesh-like strip that looks out onto the corridor.
206.
Once a day, a guard sitting behind the security glass opens an inmate's cell door so he can walk to the shower or take a turn in the concrete exercise yard. Unlike other inmates, SHU prisoners aren't allowed phone calls except in emergencies. They can't have prison jobs, have limited access to programs, and can't hug or hold hands or in any way touch visitors.
You have, 23 hours in your cell a day for self-reflection.
SHU inmate Harold Rigsby agreed to be interviewed by a room full of reporters about his experiences. When he was 16, Rigsby killed a man on behalf of a West Sacramento street gang. He says he was quickly swept up into a prison gang.
So as I came to prison, that was what I gravitated towards right there, because I seen they were the ones that controlled, the yards, and they were in control of everybody else.
Rigsby ended up in the SHU for that affiliation. And after about 13 years here, he decided to do what prison officials call debriefing, which for a gang member is effectively the only way out of the SHU beyond being released from prison on parole. Debriefing means telling prison officials everything you know about your gang, and it's controversial. Inmates in this SHU, who took part in the recent 3-week hunger strike, said debriefing is the same thing as snitching, which can open them and their families up to retaliation from the gangs they're leaving. That, and the conditions inside the SHUs, which are some of the harshest in the country, inspired the hunger strike at Pelican Bay.
There's no arguing that this is a harsh place.
Again, SHU inmate Harold Rigsby.
Of course, when I was still an active gang member, I would have wholeheartedly agreed that this is an inhumane place. But at the same time, we all have to understand that the SHU is a necessary form of prison because of all the gangs. So it's inhumane because it has to be harsh conditions.
Prison officials say they're reviewing the debriefing process and are looking at some changes that could make it easier for inmates to get out of a SHU and back to a less restrictive environment. Safety is a primary concern. But for now, at least, the SHU remains California's primary technique for fighting prison gangs. At Pelican Bay State Prison, I'm Rena Palta for Cross Currents.
To see a virtual tour of Pelican Bay State Prison and learn more about conditions in the SHU, you can go to our website. It's kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Yesterday, we heard about how life with the possibility of parole is one of the only sentences in California with reform as a goal. And we heard from Lindsay Bolar, who spent 23 years behind bars before convincing the parole board he was ready to get out.
Lifers make up your best population in prison. Those lifers have put in 20, 25 years. So if you serve 20, 25 years, you know that the mad, stupid stuff don't go no more. Then all of a sudden, you're trying to find a meaning for your life and you want to go home. So lifers become rule-binding. They obey all rules.
And the system seems to work. Only 1% of lifers return to prison after being released, and almost never for another violent crime. Still, for the past 3 decades, it has been nearly impossible to be paroled. The reasons have less to do with public safety than politics. On the second segment in our 3-part series, we'll look at the political chutes and ladders of California's parole process. KALW's Joaquin Palomino has more.
Around a quarter of California inmates are serving life with the chance of parole. Also known as lifers, they're a unique group of inmates. For starters, most have committed a horrendous crime, typically murder, rape, or kidnapping.
The crime I was charged with was murder in the second degree, and that carries a maximum sentence of 15 to life.
That's J.B. Wells. In 1983, he was sentenced to life with a chance of parole. Chance being the key word. To be paroled, Wells had to participate in programs, build up a resume, and kick a steady drug habit.
I'm a published author. I've been in famous plays. I've played the part of Lucky in Waiting for Godot. I've played the part of John Brown in John Brown's Body. And I had a really, really fabulous prison experience.
It's pretty rare to hear an inmate say he's had a fabulous prison experience. Wells' experience was largely shaped by his sentence. Life with the chance of parole is one of the only indeterminate sentences in California. meaning you can't get out until you prove you're ready. Barry Crisberg is the research and policy director at UC Berkeley's Earl Warren Institute.
The theory behind indeterminate sentencing and behind parole was some independent, objective set of experts would look at this person, look at their psychology, look at their behavior, look at the totality of the situation, and make a reasonable decision.
There aren't too many indeterminate sentences left, but they used to be the norm.
California sentencing law for almost the entire 20th century consisted of a system in which offenders would get very broad sentences. 5 years to life was a fairly typical sentence. And then the final decision as to whether or not you would be released would be determined by a parole board.
The parole board would theoretically base its decision on how reformed the inmate was, but there were flaws in the process.
In 1979, there were a number of forces that led to the end of that system and the replacement of that system with determinate sentencing.
The driving force to this overhaul was fairness. One person might get 4 years in prison for dealing drugs and another 6 months for the same crime. This led to countless accusations of discrimination. Determinate sentencing fixed that.
Under determinate sentencing, for virtually every crime, there are three potential sentences that the judge can choose from: a high sentence, a medium sentence, and a low sentence. So under determinate sentencing, you walked out of the courtroom knowing exactly how much time you were going to serve.
With the change in sentencing, the state also had to rewrite the penal code. So the legislature was put in charge of deciding which crimes carried which sentences.
And so suddenly, in this very political environment, with everybody watching, with the media there, you have elected officials who don't necessarily have training or background deciding how much penalty should be given to a given crime.
And Crisberg says that shift sparked an era of tough-on-crime politics in California.
And it almost becomes a bidding war. You know, I want to show that I'm tougher than you, so if you think a rapist should get 10 years, I think he should get 20 years. So there's been this natural escalation upward.
Life with the chance of parole was one of the few sentences excluded from this overhaul, but it wasn't excluded from the trend towards toughness.
The basic presumption that somebody with a life sentence would get out at some normal term just went out the door.
For most of the 90s and in the early 2000s, the chance of being paroled on a life sentence was under 1%. Last year, it peaked at 18%, the highest it's been in 30 years. So why has it been so difficult for lifers to gain release?
Particularly in the 1990s and into the 21st century, California was in the grips of what I would call a moral panic about crime. Voters were concerned of it. People would get defeated for office because of it. We'd have statewide elections that were strictly about criminal justice sentencing.
It was in this crime frenzy that governors became intricately tied to the parole process.
And then, in fact, there was a ballot measure which said even if the parole board granted parole, the governor could overturn it.
And the governor often does just that.
I mean, the politics of this is that if you're the governor and you release somebody or your parole board releases somebody and then that person commits a crime, it's going to be thrown in your face in the next election. In fact, the politics were irresistible to not parole anyone.
Under Governors Pete Wilson and Gray Davis, almost no life prisoners were released. And Schwarzenegger reversed 80% of his parole board's decisions.
Governor Brown is doing a little bit more in terms of paroling, but essentially the parole process has really become stuck.
J.B. Wells was one of the people who got stuck.
I was eligible in July of 1990.
And time after time, he went in front of the parole board just to be rejected.
The gravity of the offense, the heinousness of the crime, the commitment offense, that was used over and over again.
He was turned down 10 times.
I was 21 years past my minimum eligible parole date.
Then in 2008, the California Supreme Court changed the rules. the justices decided that a lifer's original crime cannot be the sole factor in the decision to grant or deny parole.
And the courts eventually said you just can't, that one just cannot continue to use that over and over and over again, because that's something that a prisoner can't change.
This law helped Wells and many others be freed. Wells says having an indeterminate sentence which aims to rehabilitate in a prison system guided by punishment creates some pretty noticeable contradictions.
And at the end of the day, corrections was actually about the bumping of heads between those people that felt that prison should be for punishment and those people that felt that prison should be for rehabilitation. Every day I experienced administrators, guards, and other people that were in charge of various functions in the prison, trying to do everything they can to be helpful, to be kind, to be patient. But there's always a few that do everything that they can to make your life as hard and as miserable as they can, because they honestly believe, and they have a right to their belief and their opinion, that prison should be as for punishment. So they're constantly looking for ways to punish.
The main theme in the past 30 years of California criminal justice has been punishment. Many believe that is the root of the state's current prison crisis and for the ballooning population of lifers. There are signs, though, that California might be moving away from its tough-on-crime trend. In 2004, Governor Schwarzenegger put rehabilitation back into the California Department of Corrections. Some lawmakers are even wondering if a return to indeterminate sentencing might be in order. For Cross Currents, I'm Joaquin Palomino.
That was the second piece in our three-part series on indeterminate sentencing. There's a lot to talk about, and many people are looking to change California's entire approach to criminal justice.
The whole idea is to take some of the bombastic posturing out of criminal justice policy and treat criminal justice as what it really is, a government program that should be subject to some kind of rational cost-benefit analysis.
Tomorrow, in the final part of this series, we'll examine calls for a statewide sentencing commission and how that could affect the prison system's approach to rehabilitation. This is Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. A couple of weeks ago, I was reading the Chronicle, and there was an item about a UC Berkeley teacher being arrested for soliciting sex in a bathroom. He's suing over it. I thought, that is so strange that police would be doing sting operations in university bathrooms. It also seems odd that consensual sex would be a crime. So we called the UC Berkeley police to figure out what the public threat is. They haven't yet responded to our requests, so I'm still really curious to understand why police are staking out public restrooms. I invited Bruce Nickerson to explain the case and its larger context. Nickerson is an attorney who specializes in gay civil rights, and he's bringing a class action lawsuit against the UC Berkeley police. Here's what he says happened.
What happened at UC Berkeley was as follows. The restroom in one of the major libraries gained a reputation, probably deserved, of being a place where gay persons met. The overwhelming majority of them, I believe, meet and then go elsewhere. Some small, insignificant minority, possibly, engage in conduct inside enclosed bathroom stalls, which, while odious, is not illegal, according to the California Supreme Court, several cases of which I argued.
Okay, so people meet in the bathroom
usually
to hook
elsewhere.
Up for sex.
Yes,
okay.
But intend to perform it elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
In that, it differs not a whit from, say, a heterosexual singles bar, where people go meet in a public place and then go to a private place to finish the evening or whatever. In this particular case, my client went there hoping to meet someone and go elsewhere. And instead, he met an undercover decoy cop who sent signals, specifically foot tapping, to indicate that he was there also for the same reason, to hook up with someone. And my client and he reached an agreement to go elsewhere, or at least to go outside and talk about where to go. And once outside, my client was arrested. I want to stress, he engaged in no sexual conduct, and his solicitation to go outside and talk about it is not an illegal solicitation.
So he was arrested and booked on what charge?
Loitering around a toilet.
Loitering around a toilet.
Intending to engage in or solicit
a lewd act. What I don't understand, there's two things that I really don't understand, which is why when I read this case, I was just shocked. Why would consensual sex between two adults be a crime?
It's not. If it's a place, this is important, where it is unlikely there will be third persons present, then it is legal.
Okay, so he's arrested. We're trying to talk with the UC Berkeley police to understand what public threat they think that there is here, because it's not clear to me. But why are they even why are police officers even doing these stings?
Because they are, I believe, prejudiced against gay persons. And the best proof of that is they never, ever do that kind of a sting targeting non-monetary heterosexual sex, ever. I repeat, ever.
That's Bruce Nickerson. He's an attorney who fights for gay civil rights, and he is fighting this case and is bringing a class action lawsuit against UC Berkeley police. So how common are these kinds of stings?
In Northern California, they're extremely rare, in large part because I have won several important cases, both at the local and at the Supreme Court level. But they are still occurring in Los Angeles, in certain parts of Orange County, under similar types of circumstances. That's where most of the cases are at the present time. In Northern California, this is a rarity. And Berkeley is the first one I've gotten.
And this man who was arrested is a lecturer at UC Berkeley. What have been the repercussions for his career?
Well, I don't wish to go into any details about him. I filed the matter under Doe. And I really don't want to make any more comments about him. I can only say that he is under extraordinary terror, that, in fact, there may be repercussions.
And so explain to us what happens next in your class action suit.
Well, actually, right now, we are in the process of exploring mediation. Neither side really wants to go to trial, I don't think. And we're hoping to find a mediator where we'll settle down and resolve it.
And what other big picture things should we know about that are happening across the nation? Again, I was really shocked to hear that this kind of a thing was even being prosecuted in this day and age. But what else should we know about?
What we need to know is that this is the last bastion of assault against gay rights. In other words, they can no longer arrest people in their bedrooms as they did in Lawrence versus Texas. They can't anymore. So therefore, and they couldn't, by the way, in California since 1976, when the legislature decriminalized private consenting sex. But what they do is they twist the nation's public sex and lewd conduct laws into criminalizing conduct by gays that when straights do it, it's ignored. That's the fun, and that happens nationwide. But what is really abominable isn't that kind of discrimination. We can live with that. It's where the police department deliberately pretends to be a decoy and enter into the cruising game for non-monetary adult sex. That's what is unique. They never, ever enter and create decoy arrests, either for soliciting or engaging, on heterosexual conduct. That is only limited to homosexual conduct, and that is across the entire country.
That's attorney Bruce Nickerson. He specializes in gay civil rights, and he's bringing a class action lawsuit against the UC Berkeley police. The teacher who was arrested is remaining anonymous for fear that publicity could ruin his career. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. And now it's time for Artery, cultural coverage that brings art and life together. 33 years ago, the assassinations of Supervisor Harvey Milk and Mayor George Moscone sent shockwaves through San Francisco. While the deaths deeply affected the city, they devastated the men's families. Jonathan Moscone, the mayor's son, was 14 years old at the time. The young Moscone struggled to move on. As an adult, he became involved in the arts, eventually becoming artistic director of California's Shakespeare Theater. While productions such as Twelfth Night and Nicholas Nickleby have been well received over the last decade, Moscone had another story to tell, one he'd avoided most of his life, the story of his father's death. KLW's Artiem's Konochovs has the story of Ghost Light, currently playing at the Berkeley Repertory Theater.
Ghost Light is a story of a father and son. According to Jonathan Moscone, it's also about the legacy of a man who made a difference in San Francisco.
For those who know the city, before George was mayor, it was not a progressively led city. And that's changed dramatically. That remains my father's legacy. And whether we feel it strongly or not, it's in the air.
But these words, they will not be held by the air. They collapse in mid-flight before reaching your ears, leaving you with only the crown of despair.
First-time playwright Tony Taccone wrote the story at once personal, political, and provocative.
He was about bringing voices to the table who hadn't been there before, and he was about giving agency and respect and power to as many different kinds of people as there are.
As mayor, George Moscone appointed many women to jobs at City Hall. At the time, that practice was rare. He did the same for underrepresented minority groups. Jonathan Moscone says his father's activism made him a polarizing figure.
I knew there were as many people who liked him who didn't like him as did like him. And we had occasional threats at home, bomb threats, and none of them were real, but they were there. And you would get stopped in the street, and people were very vocal in San Francisco, and they'd yell at my dad, and my dad would yell right back at them. You know, he was certainly did not take, he was not afraid of many people.
In this clip from Ghost Light, a character reflects on Mayor Moscone's influence on San Francisco politics.
1975, the Neanderthal age of the gay rights movement, and he's using the full force of his heterosexual brass balls to pass a bill legalizing sodomy.
Wow.
Huge controversy.
Though Ghost Light is based on certain historical facts, it's still what Moscone considers to be a dream play.
What the play does is it brings memory back into the present. And it lets the presence of somebody who has been, quote-unquote, forgotten back into the room, and that makes the adult son able to live in the present.
For the first time in his life, Moscone wanted to tell his own version of the story. Over the course of several interviews with Tony Taccone, he shared childhood memories and feelings that he had previously kept to himself. Those, along with stories from other family members, are the basis of Ghost Light.
I didn't want to interview a lot of other folks because I didn't want to be actually obligated to tell other people's stories. And I did some cursory research, mostly about John and about some historical aspects of the event, but I really wanted to be free to write a fully, almost romantically imagined play.
Taccone says he was fascinated by how the legend of a public figure can be so different from a family's personal experience.
John's mom told me this story where she was at some social event and she was approached by a guy who said to her, "I went to college with George. I just want you to know we were close friends and we just had a great college experience." And he named the college and George didn't go to that college.
She decided to let it go.
She decided it was better to like let this guy believe in his own mythology about what happened than try to fight it. And I think as a writer, I became really aware that that's what they as a family were up against.
I mean, what kind of father places a curse on his son's life, right? Well, I might ask you, what kind of son internalizes that curse until he finds himself on the brink of self-implosion?
Can we put the brakes on the projection?
Do you realize that during the entire time...
Jonathan Mosconi says reading Takuni's final script left him feeling vulnerable. Even now, after the play completed a four-month run at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, performances still leave him emotional.
You do kind of have a bit of terror running through your veins at any given moment. And every night I watch the show, I'm always sitting next to someone who recognizes, figures out who I am. And then they kind of hold my hand because they know I'm scared. And I'm like, are you okay? I'm like, who are you? And they say, I'm an usher. And I say, thank you so much.
There is humor in the performance. Reflections on what it was like to have a famous father.
As you may or may not know, we've been in development for a new candy bar that celebrates the memory of your father, and we were wondering if you might consider giving us an endorsement.
Ultimately, the play is about settling with the past.
You know, when you say his murder was overlooked, you know, at the end of the day, he was my father, and he's gone. So he's gone. And he lives only through me and my family. And so if I'm not carrying that on, if I'm not owning that in a positive way, then I'm languishing.
Ghostlight is a meditation, a different way of considering a public figure many Bay Area residents thought they knew. But it has new insights, only available when a man honestly shares his deepest feelings. In Berkeley, I'm Artem Skonohovs for Cross Currents.
KLW's Eric Jansen contributed to that story. Ghostlight is playing at the Berkeley Rep through February 19th. You can find more information at klw.org.